episode 601 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your Marvel Monday episode for the week, and I'm very briefly going to talk about my thoughts on Black Order, number one. I'm also going to go a little more in-depth, cover Fantastic Four, number three, in the more traditional style that I usually do, and also the latest issue of Daredevil that we're up to since we've started with the Charles Soule run, covering it from issue one. So I think we're on issue 9 or 10. Let me take a quick look here. Daredevil 9 is what we're going to cover. And that's it. It's kind of a smaller Marvel Monday episode. The big book that came out this last week from Marvel was obviously Uncanny X-Men number one. And there's a lot there and a lot that I may miss when I cover it, because even though I've been trying to get back into the X-Men corner of the universe, I don't know that I'm all the way there. I read it. It feels impactful. It feels important. But I'm just not sure if I'm missing things, or if there are things that we're going to get filled in on later. The other reason I wanted to keep this Marvel Monday episode a little shorter is because I'm releasing two other episodes today. It's not often I release three episodes in one day, but I wanted to be sure to get out the usual Aftershock Monday episode. And then we also had our 600th episode, and I had a real special guest on for that. So I hope you all got a chance to listen to those episodes today as well. So my thoughts on the Black Order, let me give the creative team first. It's written by Derek Landy, who is a name and a creator that I'm not familiar with. The pencils are by Philip Tan. Quite a few inkers here. We have Mark Deering, Guillermo Ortega, and Lebu Underwood on inks. We have colors by J. David Ramos, and letters are by Clayton Cowles. There's a couple of different covers. We have Philip Tan and Peter Steigerwald on the regular cover, and then there's a couple of variant covers. John Tyler Christopher did a cover, which I suppose is probably one of his patented action figure variants, and then also there was a variant by In-Huk Lee. So this didn't blow me away. I'm familiar with the Black Order from the Infinity series from back in like 2013, but I'm not intimately familiar with them. Like, I've read the Infinity series. I know they were kind of Thanos's lieutenants, if you will. I know they've shown up a lot more since then. I haven't read any stories with them in it. And I do also know that they showed up, or at least a few of them showed up in the Avengers Infinity Wars movie. So I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with who they are. And I kind of have a feeling, if it hadn't been for the fact that they showed up in that movie, that they wouldn't have warranted their own series. But maybe Marvel's trying to capitalize a little bit. I like the idea of them, but I wasn't overwhelmed by the way they were used, or with the quality of this issue. It was okay. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't great. It wasn't super compelling. The art by Philip Tan, I thought, was pretty solid, but you kind of expect that from Philip Tan. But, you know, I read it earlier today as I'm recording this, and even though I read it earlier today, I can't even remember how the issue ended. So clearly forgettable in a lot of ways. And I'm scrolling through right now to see how it ended, to kind of remind myself. Oh yeah, that's how it ended. Right. Okay. So again, I just thought it was forgettable, somewhat paint by numbers, not super compelling. It's not to say that it can't get better. There's certainly that possibility. And again, I think there are characters that can be interesting, but I just don't think that the pacing of this one and the story structure and the scripting really did it any favors. The art is clearly where it shines. The pencils by Philip Tan and the inks by that trio of inkers, as well as the colors by J. David Ramos, are all done really, really well. It's a beautiful comic to look at. But again, the story was just somewhat forgettable. So it's a 5-issue mini. I'm going to give it another issue or two to see if it gets better. But if you're really excited for this one, or just, you know, wondering how it is, I'd probably say maybe wait for the trade and kind of feel it out and, you know, read some reviews and see how other people are feeling about it to decide if you even want to spend the money on the trade. So not every comic can be a home run, and, you know, certainly don't mean to disparage any of the creative team, but it just the story in this one and the narrative just a little bit weak. All right. Next up, I wanted to talk about Fantastic Four number 3. This is from writer Dan Slott. We have art by Sarah Pacelli and Nico Leone. Colors are by Martea Garcia. Letters by Joe Caramanga. We've got Isad Ribic on the cover, and then there's some variant covers, one by Jay Lee, one by Jongju Kim, one by Mobius, and one by Scotty Young. Fantastic Four has been pretty enjoyable since they've come back, and the way issue 2 ended with Reed summoning the other members of the Fantastic Four, and when I say other members, I mean like pretty much everybody who'd ever been a member of the Fantastic Four, plus some that we didn't even know had ever been members. It was really inspired. And I also love the Sarah Pacelli art. I think she's a really talented artist. The one thing I'm worried about, though, is she's – I don't know if she's left the book or she took some time off because, you know, she was supposed to be doing this with Dan Slott for a long time. And then the more and more I hear, there are other artists filling in, and, you know, she was going to have some help on issues. And then she's – now her name's not even on those issues. So I don't know if she's moved on or what exactly is going on, but it will be a loss if she is no longer on the book. So this issue, it starts off, as I said, with Reed having brought every previous member of the Fantastic Four to help him, and the rest of the Future Foundation, because the enemy they're facing, the Griever, is looking to unmake everything. So the Griever makes a comment about the fact that, yeah, Reed may have tricked her somewhat by bringing everybody who'd ever been a member of the Fantastic Four. I mean, Wolverine, Luke Cage, Storm, Crystal, Black Panther, Spider-Man, Ghost Rider, everybody, right? And she says, well, you know, you're still just motes, right? Specks of dust adrift in the cosmos. So bring as many as you want. And Reed at that point realizes that she's right. She's right. They are not powerful enough. Even all these assembled heroes are not powerful enough to defeat her. And Reed has actually heard her voice before. At one point in his past, when he was trying to research how the universe might end so that he could possibly prevent that end, he realized it was an unsolvable problem. And heard her voice in his head saying, "You lose." And so what he gleans from that is that she's an entity. She's a cosmic entity that's far beyond any of their abilities to defeat. So he immediately formulates a plan. He sends Johnny and Ben Grimm to destroy the machine that allowed Reed to reach across dimensions or multiverses or whatever you want to call it to summon all these heroes there. And the rest of the heroes are like, did he just break the thing that could get us back to our universe? And the Griever's like, madness, I'm about to destroy this universe and that was your only way out. And Reed says, no, it was your way into our universe. And that's why you let me program it with the coordinates of our world. And something tells me you won't destroy this universe while you're standing in it, especially not after we wreck your ship. And so then he sends the entirety of the assembled heroes to destroy the ship and says, just leave one telepod working. And he holds Ben, Johnny, and Sue back, and they have a little powwow, and it's somewhat of a heartfelt reunion. Meanwhile, the kids, the rest of the Future Foundation, Valeria and Franklin have a reunion with Johnny and Ben, and Franklin is especially happy to see his Uncle Ben, and he does blame himself for letting everybody down, is the way that he puts it. So the other heroes are having a little bit of a tough time against the Griever, as Reed starts explaining that the Griever is a cosmic entity, right? Just like I said, she's or he actually calls her an embodiment, and he compares her to order, chaos, eternity, infinity, the in-betweener, abstract concepts that manifest themselves as entities. And so they don't really have any way of defeating her because she is far, far too powerful. And Valeria's like, are you saying that we should give up? And he's like, we have to accept that we can't beat her, but it doesn't mean that we have to stop her to win. There are other ways. And so he sends Valeria out to her ship, and she's like, what am I supposed to do exactly? Like, you'll know when you get there. And Johnny heads to the ship as well. And Reed then tells Franklin that he's got to confront the Griever again. Franklin doesn't want to do it. But after a pep talk from his Uncle Ben, he's up to the task. And eventually what happens is every way out of the realm but one has been destroyed. The only thing that's left is that one telepod that Reed had everybody leave intact. And because the Griever is destruction incarnate, she can't make anything. She can't fix anything. She can't repair anything. And so Reed tells her, okay, the only way to get out of this realm is the one working teleport that we left. It has enough power to get you back to your native realm. And you can leave now, or we'll destroy it, and you'll be stuck here in this one universe forever. So they don't really defeat her so much as outsmart her, which is what you kind of expect Reed to do, right? So they're willing to give up. They're like, go ahead, unmake us. You know, that's what you are. You're entropy embodied, right? You're destruction. You're, you know, the absence of creation. But because of that, you can't fix anything and you can't create anything. And so you can leave in this telepod, or you can unmake all of us and we'll destroy the telepod and you'll be stuck here forever. And then you basically stop having a reason to exist, because you unmake the universe you're in, and then what? There's nothing left to do. You can't travel. You can't continue your desire to unmake things. So the Griever makes her choice, and she does leave, saying, of course, something like, we will meet again someday. So once she leaves, the rest of the heroes are like, so now we're stuck here? I'm like, no, of course we're not. She couldn't fix things, and she had no ability to create, but we have some genius-level people here, you know, Reed Richards and Black Panther and Valeria, and you know, this ship can be repaired and we'll be able to teleport everybody home. And meanwhile, Ben informs Sue and Reed about his engagement to Alicia, and they're all happy for Ben and ready to get back home to attend the wedding. So classic FF feel to the story from Dan Slott. It really feels like a perfect way to bring the Fantastic Four back, a great story to kind of bring the Fantastic Four back into the Marvel Universe and remember what it is that they do, right? They save the day, and it's not always in the conventional way with Reed's madcap plans and seemingly finding ways to do the impossible, like turn Galactus back from devouring our world, or this is a kind of almost a similar story here with the Griever. So, and as I said, great art from Sarah Pacelli. It's got a very classic comic book feel, and also the color work from Marte Garcia is done really well. also. So I've been enjoying Fantastic Four so far, and I feel like we've just scratched the surface because there's so much here. Dan Slott's dialogue for the team feels very authentic, and I hope he's on the book for a real long time. I don't know that he could equal his Spider-Man run on Fantastic Four, but you got to wonder how many ideas the guy has, because he's a great idea man. And as I said, I think he has the voices of these characters down very well. All right, the last book I'm going to talk about is Daredevil number 9 from the Charles Soule run. We've got the creative team of Charles Soule writing, Goran Tsudzuka as the artist, Matt Miller handling the colors, and Clayton Cowles on letters. This is Blind Man's Bluff Part 2. We saw in the first part where Daredevil Matt Murdock, I should say, under an assumed name, was able to win a big tournament, a big Texas Hold'em tournament in a casino in Macau. And at the end of that issue, he meets up with Spider-Man, and that's where this issue starts off. And Spider-Man, and it's funny because Spider-Man used to be one of Daredevil's closest friends and knew that he was Matt Murdock for a long time. And now that's not the case, now that Daredevil made everybody forget. And we still don't know the details of that exactly. But the rapport is a little awkward between the two, the banter back and forth. As Spider-Man asks Daredevil, "So what's the plan, Stan?" And Daredevil says, "My name's not Stan." "It's not? Daredevil's not your real name, right? What is it?" "It's not Stan." "Well, can you tell me the plan anyway?" I don't know. It's just, it's awkward. And I don't think it's Charles Soule, because we know that he's a great scripter. So I think that what Soule is trying to convey is the awkwardness between the two. Daredevil still remembers that Spider-Man used to be a good friend and knew his identity, and they used to kind of share that, and now they don't. And it's almost like Daredevil's carrying around a little bit of guilt. He doesn't know how to act natural around Spider-Man. He's a little uptight. So he does say, "Sure, Spider-Man, I'll tell you the plan. We're going to pull off a heist, a casino heist, no less." And Spider-Man's like, "Nice, I love that movie." And Daredevil says, "Never saw it," which again goes right over Spider-Man's head because he doesn't know Daredevil's blind. Anyway, walks him through the plan. Apparently there's a briefcase on the top floor that has things in it that Daredevil needs. And normally it'd be really hard to even get up to the top floor. Once the elevator opens up, if you're not authorized to be there, it's basically shoot first, ask questions later. But since Daredevil managed to win that tournament, he actually has a penthouse on the top floor. So they've got to get that attaché case. So they've got to get that leather attaché case and whatever's in it. And Spider-Man says, "Well, sounds pretty easy, right? We just run in there and grab it." And once Daredevil tells him about all the guards and all the shooting and not asking questions and the fact that the casino is run by the Triads, Daredevil's like, "You know, you could have mentioned the possibility of a gunfight with Triads when you called me." And Daredevil says, "Would you have shown up?" And Spider-Man says, "For you, for Daredevil, one of my oldest and most trusted colleagues in the superhero biz, I'd certainly have considered it." So that's kind of key there. Again, my oldest and most trusted. So it's like the feeling is there, but the memory is not. The memory of why they trusted each other, at least on Spider-Man's part, is not there. So they head to Daredevil's room, and Spider-Man notices the check for $10 million on the table, and the fact that it's made out to Laurent Lavoisier. And Spider-Man's like, I feel like there's things that you're not telling me. And Daredevil's like, "Oh, definitely." And again, we get Spider-Man mentioning, "Well, good thing you're one of my oldest and most trusted colleagues." Daredevil says, "Sure is." And they kick down the door to the room where the briefcase is. And unfortunately, the person that has the briefcase starts running off while Daredevil and Spider-Man are preoccupied with all the other guards. And he appears to enter a safe room and manages to close the door before either of the heroes grab him. And Daredevil's pissed off at Spider-Man, like, where were you? He's like, I don't know, keeping all these guys from shooting you in the back. But don't worry, it's just a panic room. We'll have that door off the off its jams in a jiffy. But it's not a panic room. It's actually an elevator that heads to the roof. So they head up there, and Spider-Man's about to pop his head over the corner of the roof when Daredevil tackles him. And Spider-Man's like, what'd you do that for? If you wanted a hug, all you had to do was ask. He's like, look, man, there's snipers on the roof, and they would have fired the moment either of us stuck our heads above the edge. So, like, oh, should have known it was something like that. And you kind of wonder, why didn't Spider-Man's spider sense would have warned him of that, right? But anyway, the briefcase is gone, and Daredevil's like, man, I'm back to square one. You don't know how much effort I spent to set this up. And Spider-Man's like, what about me? I came all the way down from Shanghai and also got shot at. And Daredevil says, look, I appreciate that, but it's just that that briefcase was crucial to a larger plan, and I'm not sure I'll be able to replace it. Spider-Man's like, replace it? What are you talking about? Let's just go get it. Daredevil says, well, the helicopter just flew away. We have no way of knowing where it's going. Spider-Man says, it's no big deal. It's got to be heading to Hong Kong, right? Heading east. It's the only thing over there. And Daredevil's like, okay. You know that city is one of the most densely populated places on the planet, right? The guy's just going to disappear. And Spider-Man says, maybe let me worry about that. They're like, all right, well, how do we get there? Well, you know, people usually get to Hong Kong from Macau by flying, although that's really expensive. So there's plenty of other people that take the hydrofoil. So then we get this cool scene of Spider-Man hanging off the back of the hydrofoil. You can almost think of it as parasailing. And he tells Daredevil, man, you got to try this. And Daredevil says, weren't you afraid someone's going to see you? He's like, who cares? Let them look. And Daredevil does give in and try it. And he says, you know, it is great. So it's a moment of levity for Daredevil that we don't normally see. He's usually pretty pretty serious. So once they get to Hong Kong, Spider-Man even asks him, wasn't easy for you to do that, was to let go? And Daredevil says, maybe just a little bit out of character. And Spider-Man's response is, yeah, I know, you don't want to go off brand, especially when you're in a black costume phase. I've been there, pal, in a reference to Daredevil's current black and red costume. But then what Spider-Man reminds him is, once in a while, you do need to let go, man. Find joy in what we do. Otherwise, well, down that road lies Punisher Town. So it's a bit of levity from Spider-Man. It feels somewhat authentic and makes me wish that Charles Soule would have a run on the Web Slinger himself. So Spider-Man said, all right, let's go get your briefcase. And Daredevil's like, yeah, and how do we know where we're going? And that's when Spider-Man says, well, of course I put a spider tracer on the briefcase, and I've really upgraded the tech, and it makes them really hard to detect. So it doesn't take him long to track him down, to which Daredevil's response is, man, you are amazing. And once again, they attack the triads, and once again, the same guy grabs the briefcase, heads for the door. And Spider-Man says, fool me once, won't get fooled again, and shoots a web at the briefcase and yanks on it, breaks the chain that keeps it handcuffed to the guy's wrist, while Daredevil finishes off the last of the triads while ordering Spider-Man to get the briefcase out of here, and he'll meet up later. So we see just a few minutes later, on top of the building they were just in, Spider-Man's got the briefcase webbed to the top of a flagpole. On top of the building, and Daredevil thanks him for the help. And Spider-Man's response is, anytime, pal. When Daredevil asks for the case, though, Spider-Man says, you know what? I think no. Daredevil's very surprised by this. Like, excuse me? Spider-Man says, look, we just went through a lot to get to this, and you've been suspiciously quiet about exactly why or what's in it. So I find myself extremely curious, and I could just rip it open and find out what it is, but it might be something fragile or deadly, or fragile and deadly. So I thought I'd just ask, what's in the case, Daredevil? And Matt just stares at him and then throws his billy club at the briefcase, knocks it off the top of the flagpole and dives for it as it starts to fall. But before he can grab it, Spider-Man yoinks it away with a web line, and Daredevil's starting to get a little perturbed, I'd say. And he says, "Just give me the briefcase, please." Spider-Man's response is, "Nope." And again, Spider-Man himself can sense that something is not quite right here. And I think it's that awkwardness between the two that's stemming from whatever Daredevil did that erased everybody's memory. So Spider-Man says, "You know, I hope you don't take this personally." And Daredevil's like, "I haven't been ever known to hold a grudge." And Spider-Man says, "Well, that's the thing, right? It's kind of what this is all about. And what's doesn't feel quite right. You're supposed to be my oldest and most trusted superhero colleague, but I don't even know what you're known for, right? You called me all the way down here, and I have so many memories of adventures we've gone on over the years, but it doesn't feel complete. It feels like there's missing pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. So why? Why does it feel awkward? Why does it feel like something's not quite right?" And Daredevil's like, "Well, if you trust me, why don't you just give me the case?" And Spider-Man says, "Well, see, I did trust you, but now I'm not so sure. I may not trust you anymore. Like, why do I have this strange feeling?" And he's holding the briefcase over the ledge of a building. And Daredevil says, "Wait, stop, please." And he's thinking to himself, "Make something up. You can make anyone believe anything. Spider-Man wants to believe you. If you tell him even anything remotely plausible, he'll probably buy it." But then he makes a choice. He says, "You know what? Enough is enough. I'm going to just try the truth." And he says, "The reason you feel like there's a hole in your memories is because there is. Everybody used to know my identity, and I did something to change that. I'm still the man you trusted, but the only difference is now you don't know my name. And the case contains information gathered by Black Cat on most of her competitors in the New York underworld, and she was going to use it to cement her power base, but I'm planning to use it for a larger plan to get rid of all those criminals once and for all." And he lists the different criminals that he's hoping to take down. And he says, "I've been working on this for a long time, and getting my secret identity back was a part of it, and that's why I need the case." And Spider-Man says, "Well, that's absolutely fascinating information." Tosses Daredevil the briefcase and says, "Watch out for those black costume phases. They can really do a number on you." As he swings off into the sunset, leaving Daredevil holding the briefcase. So again, it makes a lot of sense. It addresses one of the big elephants in the room with Daredevil getting his secret identity back to the point where even people that he trusted implicitly, like Spider-Man, don't know his secret identity. But clearly we saw here that Spider-Man's, you know, spent a very short time around Daredevil and immediately realized, yeah, something's wrong. I couldn't have had all these memories of fighting side by side with this guy and feel this level of trust and loyalty to him, but then still have it be awkward. Like, something's wrong, something's missing. As Spider-Man says, to put it in his words, there's pieces of the jigsaw puzzle missing. So I love that Charles Soule addressed it. Again, at this point, we still don't know what exactly or how exactly Daredevil got his secret identity back, but it's beautifully scripted. It's a great classic story of Daredevil and Spider-Man teaming up, but also flipped on its head because of that awkwardness and because of the different status quo. But it's more of a lighthearted issue script-wise. Charles Soule does put quite a few little jokes and one-liners in there, and it is a Spider-Man issue, and that's, you know, kind of Spider-Man's thing. So all that works out really well. The art from Goran Sadzuka is also a little bit more traditional superhero art. It's not quite as dark and gritty as we've seen the art in Daredevil up to this point, which again just kind of suits the tone of the story a little bit more, being that Spider-Man is guest starring and they're going for a little bit more of a lighter tone. Matt Miller's colors are pretty consistent with what he's been doing all along, so those work really well also. And this two issue arc was probably my favorite of the early run on Daredevil for Charles Soule. And as I'm rereading all of them, it may end up being my favorite part of the entire run of Charles Soule. It's just this two-issue arc, just because it was so fun to see Matt gambling, even though he couldn't see the cards, and basically playing the man instead of the cards. And also having Spider-Man show up, I thought was so much fun. So we'll continue to cover the Charles Soule issues as his run on Daredevil winds down, because, I think they're just really fun, exceptionally well done. And Charles really explores a lot of what it means to be a blind superhero, maybe more so than anyone's ever done before. So that's going to do it for this episode. As I said, kind of a shorter episode, didn't cover a lot of books, or honestly just weren't a lot of Marvel books that came out last week that interested me. But that Uncanny X-Men was the big book, as I said, and I'll be talking about that on Tuesday's X-Men Spotlight. So once again, I want to thank everybody for joining. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platforms you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.